We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Big, well, medium-size election this week.
The primary election, yes, yep. this past Tuesday.
In the middle of August, yep.
Yeah, and voter turnout was low, as expected, for an August primary when lots of people are on vacation or they're just not paying attention. And it's an off year, so they're not interested in marking their ballots and mailing them in. So the results in the primary are not necessarily going to tell us how things will happen in November, but it is sort of a small interesting preview, and it will narrow down the field in some critical local races. And I'll just start with the federal race for the U.S. Senate. Of course, Patty Murray made it through. Her main Republican challenger in the fall will be Tiffany Smiley.
Who is nuts.
Yeah, so Patty Murray, looks like Patty Murray will be a shoo-in in November. For the U.S. House of Representatives, there are 10 districts in Washington state. In most of the districts, the Democratic incumbent kind of ran away with the primary election and took the vast majority of the votes. So in District 1, it's the incumbent Democrat Susan Del Bene and Republican Vincent Cavalieri. Del Bene looks like she'll win.
She won easily this time.
Yeah. Right. District 2.
And bear in mind that November ballots tend to be less conservative, skewing younger than August primaries. So it tends to favor the Democrats compared to the results this week.
Yeah, and that will make a difference, I think, in at least one of these 10 races. In District 2.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, in District 2, Democrat Rick Larson ran away with it, and he'll face Republican Dan Matthews in the fall. In District 3,
let's talk about District 3.
Yeah, that's the race where I think it's really going to matter. The Democrat, Marie Glusenkamp-Perez, not only made it through the primary, but she's the leader in that race. Of course, the Republican vote was split between incumbent Jamie Herrera-Butler, who has, at this moment, a very, very slim lead of about 257 votes ahead of her Trump-financed opponent, Joe Kent. So that could still flip, depending on how many votes are left to count.
Kent has been making up ground every day, and he's the prohibitive favorite to come out in second place at this point and oust the incumbent because she voted to impeach Trump.
Yeah, and, you know, if Kent knocks Butler out of the race, then I think Democrat Marie Glusenkamp-Perez has a real shot at winning that district and flipping it to the Democrats.
Yeah,
Kent is nuts.
Yeah, that district is Southwest Washington State. And, you know, Clark County is probably one of the fastest growing counties in the state now, getting a lot of suburban residents from Portland. Mm-hmm. And so it's becoming increasingly less conservative, if that is grammatically correct.
This may be the year. Yeah.
We'll see.
And in District 4 here in Washington, the Republican incumbent, it's, you know, Central Washington, Republican incumbent Dan Newhouse and Democrat Doug White are running neck and neck, and that's kind of interesting. Although there were Republican challengers to Newhouse.
Yeah, notably Lauren Kemp, who is still not conceded still not conceded the governor's race from 2000, which tells you about how nuts he is. He drew a lot of votes from Newhouse. And the question for November is, okay, Republicans got a lot more votes in the primary than Democrats did, but it was split. And will the Democratic challenger be able to pick up some of the people who were disaffected with Newhouse?
Yeah, and you know, in past years, the Democratic challenger for Dan Newhouse has not usually been a great candidate that people could really get behind. This year, I think Doug White is someone that more conservative Democrats can really support. So that might pick up a whole lot of people in rural central Washington state who would otherwise vote for a mainstream Republican who might be tired of Dan White, might be tired, or Dan Newhouse, might be tired of the Republican policies. So
yeah, there's really no such thing as a mainstream Republican anymore. But yes.
Yeah, true. I think Dan Newhouse is one of a fading group.
And bear in mind, he was challenged because he also voted to impeach Trump. Mm-hmm. So he has survived the Trump-backed challenge from Culp.
Yeah. Now, in District 5, which is Eastern Washington, Republican incumbent Kathy McMorris Rogers kind of ran away with that. She'll face Democrat Natasha Hill. The Democrats the Democrats' votes were split between two candidates, though. So if the November ballot brings out more youth and more Democrats, Natasha Hill has a real chance against Kathy McMorris Rogers, but we'll see. So that's another interesting race to keep an eye on.
Bear in mind that McMorris Rogers has been in the leadership of the Republican Party for the last decade. Mm-hmm. So she bears a lot of responsibility for the lunacy in Washington, D.C.
Certainly does. Now, in District 6, Democrat Derek Kilmer and Republican, Elizabeth Kreiselmeyer will make it through to November. Here in Seattle in District 7, of course, Democrat incumbent Pramila Jayapal took 85% of the vote. An amazing
She's not majority. Too worried about November.
No, and she'll face Republican Cliff Moon. District 8, the Democratic incumbent Kim Schreier took the lead in that district with no real Democratic opposition. She will face Republican Matt Larkin, it looks like, who currently has a 4,866 vote lead against Reagan Dunn, and I doubt that Dunn will be able to close that gap in the coming days.
Because he has not been making up ground over the past several days since Tuesday. Now, Schreier won with 48% of the vote compared to only 17% for Larkin. Larkin, of course, the Republican vote was split among a number of challengers, including Dunn. But Larkin's pretty nuts. So hopefully Schreier can get over the 50% mark. But that race, Republicans have been targeting it as somebody who's vulnerable and as a Democratic incumbent. So
yeah,
we'll see how that goes.
They're still not happy that Schreier flipped the district from Republican to Democrat, and they want to take it back. So they're going to put a lot of money in there. Matt Larkin has proven himself as someone who can raise a lot of money and who can get a lot of endorsements and a lot of support. So that's going to probably be a stiff race for her in November.
Yep.
District 9, also here in Seattle, the longtime Democrat incumbent Adam Smith made it through with a giant majority of the vote. He'll face Republican Doug Baszler in November. And then in District 10, Democrat Marilyn Strickland made it through, and her Republican opponent will be Keith Swank in November. Doesn't look like he will be able to challenge her in that district. So those are the federal races. We look at the Washington Secretary of State race. The Democrat Steve Hobbs took the lead with 41%, so quite a bit of the vote. The Republican vote was split between four candidates, with Julie Anderson, who is the former Pierce County auditor, running essentially. She said she was not a Republican, that she was non-affiliated. She nevertheless is listed as a Republican in the voter's pamphlet.
No, she's listed as nonpartisan on the ballot, though.
Okay. And she's holding a 16,878 vote lead over Republican State Senator Keith Wagoner. So it looks like she's going to be the one to face Steve Hobbs in November. Notably, I want to point this out. Republican Mark Malosia, who is a former state representative and one-term state senator and is a fundamentalist Christian, he got less than 10% of the vote. Now, Malosia is the former director of the Anti-Abortion Family Policy Institute. He's expressed a lot of support for Donald Trump, his fascist policies, and conspiracy theories like Pizzagate, you know, the that idiotic lie that Democrats were holding child sacrifices in the non-existent basement of a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. Yeah, he's just a total nutcase. Now, the fact that he could nevertheless get 171,000 votes is, I think, a reminder of just how crazy the Republican Party has gotten in recent years.
And I also want to point out that nationally there's been a serious campaign for, 2020 election deniers, people who say the vote was stolen from Trump, et cetera, to run for and potentially win Secretary of State offices, in which case those would be the people overseeing the elections. We're not going to have that in Washington State, and that's a huge bullet dodged because there were several candidates running, including Malosha, who were espousing that kind of nonsense.
All on the Republican ticket. And I think that's why Julie Anderson went nonpartisan, is so that she wouldn't have to face those kinds of questions.
Yes.
So it'll be Steve Hobbs and Julie Anderson in November. Now, if we look at the state legislature, most races had one Democrat and one Republican, with an occasional third party or unaffiliated candidate who will peel off for the November. But in the contested seats for state senator, there were two races contested. One was the District 36 seat. That's Reuben Carlisle is retiring. Noel Frame jumped from state rep in that district to run for state senator. She took 82% of the vote against Kate Martin, which, again, is very reassuring since Martin, who pretends to be a Democrat, is actually kind of falls into the nutcase category.
She's seriously nutcase category. Yeah. And, they were the only two people on that ballot. So Martin was almost assured of getting through to November, particularly since he's run for several, elected offices in the past, including mayor of Seattle. And so she has a certain amount of name recognition for people.
Yeah. Now, for state senator in District 46, the other contested seat, that is Dave Frock's old seat. He's also retiring. Javier Valdez jumped from being state rep in that district to running for state senator. He took 83% of the vote. He will face the other Democrat, Matthew Gross, a deputy King County prosecuting attorney who just didn't garner much support. So it looks like Noel Frame and Javier Valdez will be joining the Senate in the coming year. Now, for House of Representatives, there were a few districts with contested seats. In District 34, Position 1, Eileen Cody is retiring. Emily Alvarado took the lead with 54% of the vote, so already more than 50% against her challengers. Leah Griffin will be facing her in November. In District 36, Position 1, that's the seat that Noel Frame is giving up to run for state senate, in a race with five Democrats. The two who are going to make it through to November are Julia Reed, who took 55% of the vote. Looks like she's the leader in that field, with Jeff Manson, who had under 14%. So unless Reed has a scandal, it looks like she's going to be joining the state legislature. Now, in District 37, Position 2, four Democrats ran for the seat that Kirsten Harris Talley is leaving.
Yeah.
John?
Go ahead.
The two who garnered the most support are Chipolo Street and Imijah Smith. They'll make it through to November. They took about 42% and 36% respectively. So that race is a little closer and is probably going to be more fiercely fought in November.
There were only 2,000 votes that separated them. And, something like 8,000 votes for other candidates in that race. So there's plenty of room for either candidate to win in November.
Yeah, and since there will be more voters in November, it's pretty difficult looking at these results to know which one of those two is the leader in that race. It's going to be a hotly contested seat.
Yeah, now, I think Street has shown more fundraising ability. That's his other advantage.
Yeah,
so we'll see.
This next race, which shows that fundraising ability isn't necessarily what determines who makes it through in District 46 position.
I know where you're going. Yep.
Yeah. This is the seat that Javier Valdez is giving up to run for state senate. Of the five Democrats running in that race, the progressive candidate Daria Farivar took the lead away from Laylock Rave. Laylock Rave was leading on election day, but as the later ballots came in, Daria Farivar took the lead away from her. She has 32% of the vote to Rave's 28%.
Yeah, and then Melissa Taylor came in third with 19%.
Yeah, and you know, that's a really nice surprise, especially since Daria Farivar raised less than half the money of her two main opponents, Taylor and Rave. And typically you don't see that, but I think it's really great when I'm wrong and the underdog progressive candidate makes it through and does such a good job. So we'll see in November. That's also going to be a very hotly contested race, and it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. So that's my wrap up of the local.
Yep,
of the local.
It's good
races,
and we'll talk about national in a little bit because there were some other primaries this week as well.
Yes, spreading the excitement across the country.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's move on then. If nothing else about that, but related to that, the Salary Redistricting Commission.
Yes. With every 10 years, the United States does a census. And once the census results come out, the states and local municipalities can do redistricting based on the new census numbers to draw districts that are supposed to be proportional in terms of population and fair in terms of representation. That whole process is usually governed by a state charter or, in our case, a city charter. Now, the Seattle Redistricting Commission, it's a 5-member board. They released their proposed map this week for new Seattle City Council districts that will take into account population increases in the city of Seattle with the 2020 census. Now,
I was amused to see that the chairman of that commission is none other than former Mayor Greg Nichols. So, you know, people who are drummed out of office in disgrace don't disappear in the city.
No, they don't. It's worth noting that the mayor appoints two people to the commission, the city council appoints two, and then those four members of the commission appoint a fifth person. Mayor Jenny Durkin, one of her two appointments was Greg Nichols, so that's how he got on.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know. So I was looking at the draft map that the Redistricting Commission has released. You know, the population changes were different in each district. Some grew more than others, so the boundaries had to be redrawn to add people to some districts and to subtract people from others. So, but there's typically an emphasis on not changing things too much. So how do you draw the boundaries in a way that doesn't just redraw the districts super dramatically? Sometimes you just shift the boundaries a little bit in one part of a district.
Or creating boundaries that are, you know, gerrymandered and ridiculous.
Yeah, that look like some weird ink blot or splatter. You want something that looks like it will keep neighborhoods together, that it's not going to split up groups demographically throughout the city. So I just wanted to there were six big changes I wanted to talk about. First off, starting in the north end of the city, you have District 5, which is Deborah Warris's district. It didn't see as much population growth as other districts, so it needed to gain some territory to add population. And the draft map would give, in the west side of the district, would take some territory away from District 6, just to the south of it. It would give Crown Hill and the northern part of North Beach to District 5. Okay, that means District 6, then needed to shift its boundaries somewhere else to gain just a little more population. And because District 4 in the east, that's Alex Peterson's district, didn't change much, so it didn't need to add any population or add any territory. That boundary remains the same. Instead, District 6 will gain most of Magnolia from District 7 to the south. So jumps across the ship canal and takes a chunk of Western Magnolia. Okay, so that's the change to District 6. District 7, that's Andrew Lewis's district. Formerly was Magnolia, Queen Anne, downtown, South Lake Union, etc. That district gained a lot of population. So it's also going to have its other boundaries change around it. So it gives up a small strip of Pioneer Square in the south to District 1. But it will also gain, it will also gain most of the area around west of I-5 to the east of South Lake Union, which was formerly in District 3. So it gets a little bit more of the south, kind of around South Lake Union area, to balance out the numbers, some of the population that it gives away to the south and that it gives away to District 6.
And that disadvantages Shama Sawant, should she choose to run again in 2023.
Well, we'll see. Because I think a lot of the folks who live around in that area are probably wealthier. That's Lakeview property there.
East Lake, that is one of the few working class apartments in that area. So that it really is not that.
I beg to differ. You go one block off of East Lake and those tend to be really nice condos in there now. Yeah, I beg to differ there. I think that's actually may disadvantage Andrew Lewis a little bit. Now, the really big changes, however, are in the south and east end. So District 3 does change quite a bit, I think. And these changes could affect at least two of the three candidates representing these three remaining districts. So District 3, which is Shama Sawant's district, it's going to gain the western tip of the Roanoke Peninsula around Portage Bay. Again, viewfront property. So
yeah, that's very high end. Yes.
That's in the northwest part of her district. District 3 will also lose the remnants of Yesler Terrace. It has about half of Yesler Terrace, and it's going to lose that to District 2 to the south, and it's going to lose a big chunk of the Mount Baker neighborhood south of I-90 to District 2. That's going to change the demographic of voters in District 3, and that could really impact Shama Sawant's next reelection campaign if she gains more wealthy folks living on the Roanoke Peninsula and then loses a significant number of lower-income folks in the Yesler Terrace, Mount Baker area. So that's a big change.
And because Mount Baker tends to be, single family, housing, it's one of the few areas left in District 3 that can be easily door built. And that's important for Sawant as well.
Yeah. Now in District 2, just south of District 3, and that's Tammy Morales's district, it's going to gain Yesler Terrace. And it's going to keep the International District in the very northwest tip of the district. And then it's going to gain the northern half of Mount Baker, but it's going to lose a long strip of territory to the west because the new western boundary is going to be shifted from the Duwamish Waterway east to the I-5 corridor. Okay. That's the whole industrial area of Seattle. That means that Lisa Herbold's District 1 is going to gain that small strip of Pioneer Square from District 7 in the north, but it's also going to gain all of Soto, the industrial district, and Georgetown. And again, that's also going to shift the demographics in her district, and I think especially reflect the willingness of businesses in those neighborhoods to fund opposition candidates to Herbold. So there may not be a lot of higher income folks living in that district, but the businesses in your district also play an outsized role in funding candidates that run for office to represent the district where they have their businesses. And I think that could impact the next city council race for her.
Yeah, and Herbold's opponents, both when she was elected and when she was reelected, were heavily funded by business interests.
Yeah. So I think she's going to keep seeing that in District 1. Now, if you want to take a closer look at the map, it's available on the Seattle Redistricting Commission website. That's at www.seattle.gov/redistricting. Okay. There's an interactive map there where you can zoom in and see the actual streets that are the proposed new boundaries. Now, the commission will be holding 3 public meetings to answer questions and take comments from the public, and you can also make comments on their website as well as view the map there. The meetings are going to be held over the next 3 weeks, and all of them are on Tuesdays from noon to 1:30 at City Hall at 600 4th Avenue. That's at 4th and James downtown. The first one is this coming Tuesday on August 9th, noon to 1:30. There's also a virtual link that you can click on their website to join and attend if you don't want to be there in person. And again, you can make comments on their website too.
Yes. And once again, you know, a Seattle public meeting is held during the day when most people work and can't get off work to go.
Yeah, that's why I think it's important to visit the website, take a look at the map, zoom in on your district and look at the boundaries, and then make comments there on the website if you can on your own time. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that wraps up the redistricting.
All right. Other Seattle City related news this week?
Yeah, there's some smaller items I wanted to talk about, too. This week at the full city council meeting on Tuesday, the council passed a bill to end the hazard pay ordinance that the council passed in February of 2021, which required grocery stores to pay their employees an extra $4 per hour in hazard pay during the COVID-19 pandemic. The vote to pass the repeal of the ordinance was 5-2, with Deborah Juarez, Andrew Lewis, Sarah Nelson, Alex Peterson, and Dan Strauss voting yes, and Tammy Morales and Shama Sawant voting no, and both Lisa Herbold and Teresa Mosqueda were absent, but their presence wouldn't have changed the outcome, I don't think. So that will be repealed as soon as the ordinance goes into effect.
I had that item in pandemic news, but it's very frustrating since the pandemic isn't over. It's still hazardous to be working a frontline service job, just as it was in 2020.
Yes, it is.
Nobody's wearing masks now.
Yeah, and there's a new one launching, a parallel one with the monkey box, you know.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit in a minute.
We will. Okay. The council also passed legislation sponsored by Alex Peterson and Dan Strauss to limit the fees that restaurants have to pay to third-party delivery services. Now, in 2020, the council adopted, as part of its emergency COVID-19 legislation, a 15% cap on fees that outside delivery companies could charge restaurants who rely on their services in order to get their food delivered to their customers. Council Bill 120379 now makes that 15% cap permanent in as a city ordinance. So that's good news.
Well, how will DoorDash or Uber Eats possibly make money?
Exactly. At that same meeting, the council voted to appoint 9 members to the new Indigenous Advisory Council. The new members will have 2-year terms. And that new board was created by an ordinance the city council passed last year. Its role will be to advise the mayor, city council, and other city departments on issues and projects facing Native American communities and to provide input on city government policies, especially budgets, and their effect on Indigenous communities. So I know that Deborah Juarez, city council president, she pushed hard for that, and she was very proud of the launch of that council, the Indigenous Advisory Council.
I would hope they'll have something to say about homelessness policies as well, since there's an awful lot of Indigenous people on the street in Seattle.
Yes, I think that's going to be one of their main topics. Now, also this week, the mayor's office added 2 additional public meetings to gather input on the search for a new Seattle police chief. This coming Wednesday, August 10th, from 6 to 8 p.m., and the next day, Thursday, August 11th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., both meetings will be held at South Park Hall at 1253 South Cloverdale Street. The meetings will be to gather input from the community. So I like that once again, the mayor's office announced them just days before they were going to take place, not a couple weeks to give people adequate notice.
Okay. When you say added, are you saying those are on top of the previously five scheduled ones?
Those were on top of the ones in July. They just added these and they just announced them, I think, on Friday.
Okay.
Okay. Again, just days before they're set to meet. Now, finally, in city news, how's our neighbors, the coalition that was gathering signatures or is still gathering signatures to put Initiative 135 for social housing on the November ballot, said this week that it looks like they won't be able to make the deadline for November. They announced on July 22nd that the initiative was more than 5,000 signatures short of what it needed to qualify, and that the majority of the rejected signatures were voters who had moved to a new address, which they then wrote on their initiative petition. That's really common for people who rent. And if your rent's going up all the time, you move frequently. And if you put your new address on an initiative petition and it doesn't match the address that's in the Department of Elections database, then your signature gets rejected for an address mismatch. Now, the campaign had a 20-day extension window in which to gather more signatures, but how's our neighbors said this week that they were unlikely to get the total they needed in time to get the initiative certified for the November ballot. The soonest it could go on the ballot is February. So that was what they said this week. Kind of unfortunate, because more people vote and more progressive folks vote in November. A February vote would tend to be more conservative and possibly much lower turnout and not as favorable to the initiative itself.
February elections almost never have a high turnout.
Yeah.
It's very difficult sledding for an initiative.
Yeah. So that was a bummer to hear that this week.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely. That wraps up my city news.
All right. Well, let's dive back into this week's pandemics.
Yes, it's plural now.
Yes.
The United States declared a public health emergency because of the spread of monkeypox. It's had several hundred cases in New York City now. Houston has had a doubling of cases in the last 2 weeks. It's contagious and it's spreading. And people are not availing themselves of the vaccines in large numbers. Partly that's because of very long waits for vaccines. People in Seattle have been reporting going up to Canada to get vaccines because the wait in Seattle is just, you know, it can be several hours to stand in line. And as I was saying last week, in an enclosed indoor space. And similar, you know, similar long waits in the Bay Area. So the number of people who've actually gotten vaccinated against monkeypox remains relatively low. The number of people who've been getting booster shots remains relatively low, which means they're vulnerable to Omicron. So we're continuing to see numbers go up across the country. In King County, they've been flat for a couple of months now. So that's good news, except it's flat at a relatively high number. So you're still not safe. Still take precautions. As we talked about last week with monkeypox, that spreads through airborne, through physical contact, or through ingestion. So monkeypox is also contagious, and the things that prevent it are the same things that prevent getting COVID or getting severe COVID. Vaccination, number one, first and foremost. Wearing masks, particularly in indoor spaces that are not well ventilated. You know, social distancing, all the things we learned a couple of years ago are still in effect.
Wash your hands, wash your produce from the store.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's very difficult to get, COVID-19 through physical contact, through, you know, surfaces, that kind of thing. It's possible, but it's not likely. But for monkeypox, it's much more possible. So, and they're still trying to get clarity on that. So take precautions, you know, be safe, be wise, be healthy.
Yeah, and, you know, just from a public health perspective, people tend to, one of the main illnesses that people tend to get from from fresh produce is E. coli, and sometimes really severe E. coli that can kill you. So I think it's really important not to skip washing your produce. Just, you know, put it in a bowl of soapy water, for let it soak for a bit, rinse it off, scrub it, and you're good.
Yep, I made that mistake once. Well, never again.
Yeah.
All right. But just because you posted about this online last week, but you tend to not get COVID from touching produce.
No, you tend to not get COVID from touching cherries in the grocery store.
Contrary to what some security guards think.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's true.
Monkeypox, the jury's more out on that.
Yeah.
So yes, no.
Still be careful.
What Mike is referring to is I had a security guard come up to me this week at a Safeway store and start ranting at me because I had moved some cherries from one bag into another because I only wanted a half a bag of cherries instead of a full bag. And his point was that I was contaminating the cherries with my COVID germs. And I pointed out to him, probably unhelpfully from his point of view, that I was wearing a mask and he was not, and that was more of a risk. So, actually, I got thrown out of the Safeway store by someone who obviously doesn't know anything about how COVID-19 spreads. So it's really important that people educate themselves and that you stay on top of what you really need to do to protect yourself and other people.
That safe in that Safeway store to begin with.
Oh, yeah, no, and I'm not going back to that store again. That was uncalled for and a terrible experience.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that is why the COVID-19 virus is still spreading, is because there's a lot of people out there who think they know and they don't. And they don't listen if you actually tell them how things are spreading. So I think it's just really important to try to keep yourself safe and to gently and kindly speak to those you care about so that they're doing what they can to keep themselves and you safe.
All right. Let's move on. Unless there's anything else on the pandemics, let's move on to national elections that happened this week.
Yeah, there were primaries in several other states beyond Washington State. The big national news was the results in Kansas, which held a referendum that was trying to repeal that state's constitution's protection for abortion rights. And the no vote, which is the vote for pro-choice, won. Not only won, which was in itself a surprise, but won handily, 59% to 40%. And we saw not just the more liberal urban areas voting no, but also a lot of Trump-supporting rural districts. Now, the campaign to preserve abortion rights was very smart. Their ads never mentioned abortion. What they talked about was the government infringing on your freedom. And that's a message that, more centrist and conservative people can hear. And it gave hope for Democrats for November. Now, unfortunately, a lot of the primaries around the country, particularly in Arizona and Michigan, Republican, the sort of nutso candidates, advanced to the November election. This is a particular concern in Arizona, where the Secretary of State's race, the leading vote getter, was somebody who's claiming that Trump really won in 2020. And of course, Arizona has had any number of efforts to prove that, all of which have fallen flat in the past. But if that person, one of those people, is running the state election, that's very dangerous for 2024. Similarly, the Republican.
Yeah, she's talked about ending mail-in ballots, about closing ballot boxes, all kinds of ways to suppress the vote in Arizona.
Yeah. The Senate race in Arizona, again, the Masters, the candidate who advanced to face the incumbent, Mark Kelly, a Democrat, he is very, very extreme. And has, talked about, how democracy really does not serve the United States well at this point, and a number of things along that lines, questioning U.S. involvement in World War II, you know, any number of positions that are on the far, far fringe of the political spectrum, although they may be mainstream by November. And
we'll
see.
We'll see how, if these kind of crazy Republican candidates can, you know, be ousted or can be held off by the Democratic candidates in those races.
Yeah, and, you know, we were hearing a few months ago about how the Republicans were going to take over the Senate as well as the House. That's looking less likely now, and specifically because of some of these candidates, and also in states like Georgia and Pennsylvania, where the Republicans have nominated really flawed nominees to face the Democrats. You know, Herschel Walker has had a new scandal almost every week about his past and statements he's made and people he's impregnated and so forth. And the same for the Republican candidate in Pennsylvania, Dr. Oz. So, you know, in some ways it's good for Democrats. In the long run, it's probably bad because it mainstreams these ideas among Republicans. Yeah, we'll see how November turns out. It's going to be very competitive and very close for control of the House and the Senate.
All right. Okay, moving on. The Department of Justice weighing in this week with Louisville officers, police.
Oh, yes. I didn't know that wasn't where I thought you were going to go. Four police officers in Louisville, Kentucky, who were involved in the shooting and killing of Breonna Taylor in March of 2020, were charged this week by the Department of Justice. They were charged with a number of various crimes. Some of them lied to investigators, and some of them, of course, violated Breonna's civil rights. She was shot in the middle of the night while she was in her bed by a botched SWAT team raid, who was basically raiding a house that had nothing to do with the suspect in the case. They were
serving a no-knock warrant.
Yeah, and no-knock warrants have been outlawed in a number of places as a result of that.
Right, but I believe the bullet that killed her was fired by an officer who shot through a window. Isn't
yes.
that correct? Into her apartment.
And also into adjacent apartments.
Mm-hmm.
He was a terrible shot, as it turns out. But
just shooting through a window. I mean, not even upon entering the apartment and encountering resistance, just kind of firing hazardously through a window. That's insane.
Yeah.
And there's no way that can be allowed to stand as proper policing policy anywhere.
Yeah, and the Republican Attorney General of Kentucky declined to file charges in the case, and so the DOJ now has stepped in.
Yeah.
Which was good news, I think. Mm-hmm. Something like that has needed to happen.
Yeah.
All right. And where you probably thought it was going was any updates this week on the January 6th hearings?
Well, the January 6th investigation, we definitely found out that a third Trump-run department had erased its emails and texts. That is the Department of Defense. There are a number of texts missing from senior Trump appointees, people like Christopher Miller and the guy who was running the Pentagon for a hot minute after the election. These were all Trump appointees, and magically their communications for January 6th and 5th are missing. That they and those are critical because these were the people that were in charge of mobilizing the National Guard or doing any kind of response to requests for help at the Capitol on January 6th during the insurrection. So you can add that to the Department of Justice, to the Department of Homeland Security and to the Secret Service as agencies where texts are missing now, and it starts to look like an order went out from the White House. that this is not coincidence that three separate departments all erased their text messages.
I would agree with that. It looks like somebody was coordinating this cover up.
Yeah. And we also found out this week that former White House counsel Pat Cipollone, who testified eventually to the January 6th committee, has now been subpoenaed to testify at a grand jury that's being run by the Department of Justice on the January 6th investigation. So that investigation does look like it's moving along. Donald Trump had a very bad week legally. His lawyers are saying now they're talking to the Department of Justice about deposing Trump, which would be very bad news for him and Dee because he cannot tell the truth to save his life. So, anytime you get him under oath, it's a win because he's going to incriminate himself or he's going to plead the fifth or he's going to lie. So, that's the wrap up for this week, but it is moving along. They're going to continue to operate during the congressional recess later this month. And, then we'll probably have another couple of public hearings in January or in September rather.
September. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Didn't get to it last week, but, the climate and healthcare bills.
Yeah, some changes this week to the climate and healthcare bills. There were three big tax-related changes because the bills had to be run after Chuck Schumer got an agreement from Joe Manchin. He had to run the bills by the other conservative Democrat in the Senate. That's Kyrsten Sinema. Kyrsten Sinema objected to the provision that would have tightened a loophole for private equity compensation for hedge fund managers, the so-called carried interest loophole. So that was dropped out of the bill.
That was huge, too.
Yeah, instead of paying 37% tax, that's the top tax bracket on their compensation, hedge fund managers under current law pay only about 20% on that compensation, often a lower tax rate than their secretaries, right? It's one of the biggest tax loopholes that rich people enjoy, and the bill would have closed it somewhat, but nope. Even that little bit of gaining a fair tax rate from these wealthy guys was too much for Kyrsten Sinema, and that's out of the bill. Now, the 15% corporate, the second change is the 15% corporate tax rate was revised, again, at Kyrsten Sinema's insistence, to add another loophole for corporations to accelerate depreciation on new equipment purchases, something that they've been enjoying quite a bit during the COVID pandemic. That trims the amount of money that will be collected by the tax from $313 billion down to $258 billion. The 15% minimum tax will apply to about 150 of the biggest corporations in America with incomes exceeding $1 billion. However, with accelerated depreciation, all they need to do is accelerate some new equipment purchases, and they can write those off much, much more quickly. And then the third change is a new tax was added, ostensibly to offset the closing the carried interest loophole. The new tax would be on companies that buy back their own stock. They will now pay a 1% tax on those transactions. It's estimated that this tax could bring in about $74 billion over the next decade. But that estimate, you know, is based on prior behavior, companies buying back their stock in order to boost their share prices. But that's discretionary behavior. Okay. A company can choose to not do that and not pay the tax. And it's not something that companies do every year. So it's really hard to get a good estimate of exactly how much that tax would raise. And it wouldn't be a steady or reliable source of revenue. Although it is expected to discourage some corporations from using their enormous cash profits to just boost the price of their own stock. But instead, you know, they could just buy new equipment and write that off faster and still get a tax, get a double tax break under these changes to the climate and healthcare bills. Oh, so, I'm seeing these as primarily negative changes.
Yes, agreed.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there will be some other changes as it makes its way through the House and Senate. We'll just see.
All right. Bouncing back to the federal government filing a suit against Idaho.
Yeah, the Justice Department this week filed a lawsuit against the state of Idaho, over its ban on abortion, saying that it conflicts with federal law, and they're referring to the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, which requires medical facilities to treat anyone who comes to them for emergency medical treatment, to treat them and treat them responsibly and provide them with the best care possible. Now, the Idaho law makes it a crime to provide an abortion to a woman, even when she's suffering a medical emergency that requires an abortion. This was a trigger law that went into effect when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Now, patients who are suffering partial miscarriages in states with trigger laws are already reporting that their doctors are unsure of how to treat them. And many hospitals are denying these women necessary abortions and D&Cs after they've miscarried or suffered a partial miscarriage. And instead, those women are being forced to wait days or sometimes weeks to contract serious life-threatening infections before their doctors will provide them with a necessary medical procedure. Okay.
And even then, some have had to be moved to other states.
To get the procedure before it threatens their life and threatens their ability to have future children. I mean, these are women who got pregnant. A lot of these are women who got pregnant on purpose and want to have kids. And they don't want a miscarriage to end their reproductive life, okay? And I have to say that denying women necessary medical procedure like this is a violation, not only a violation of federal law, it's a real violation of their human rights, okay?
Yes, absolutely.
And
we're seeing this, you know, hospitals are denying this not just because of directly because of the laws, but because the insurance won't cover it because they're afraid of being, you know, held liable for it. So,
there's a liability issue there when the law contains, criminal prosecution elements like sending doctors to prison if they give a woman an abortion in these states. So now, this is the first lawsuit filed by the federal government against a trigger law banning abortion, but it likely won't be the last. And, of course, there are some private lawsuits in the works, too. Planned Parenthood has a lawsuit that it filed in Idaho that's headed for the Idaho Supreme Court. Now, I should point out that the courts, especially the federal courts, are more conservative now and that it's really up to Congress to act. And I have to say that in this case, it's really an example of why the Senate and the Democrats in the Senate should have repealed the filibuster. Because with female pro-choice Republican senators like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski on their side, the Democrats could have had enough of a majority to pass a bill that would have guaranteed a woman's right to choose. And we wouldn't be in this mess right now. But with the filibuster, the Democrats and pro-choice Republicans are just short of that majority that's needed to overcome a filibuster for this. And that's
or to abolish the filibuster
crazy.
In the first place, because that only takes 15.
Yeah.
Or it's been it up, but, you know, you have to get past a filibuster to pass it.
True. Now, last month, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services released an order to all hospitals in the United States telling them that they must provide abortions to women when their lives are at risk, as required under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. And guess what? The state of Texas promptly sued the federal government over this. And the Texas governor and attorney general seem pretty confident that the courts will be on their side. I think that, again, is another illustration of why Congress, of the dysfunctionality in Congress and why Congress should act on this.
And a special shout out to the state of Indiana, which became the first state post Roe v. Wade to absolutely ban all abortions, contravening that federal order and not making no exceptions, even when the one's life is at risk.
Yeah, and I want to point out that unlike in Kansas, where the voters turned down an abortion ban, in Indiana it was the state legislature and the conservative governor who passed this law.
Yeah. Okay. And we have had a court in Georgia rule that embryos can be considered dependent on residents' state tax returns, which is insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crazy. Okay. Now, doctors also, there's a report that doctors.
You just don't know what to do with these stories because they're so nuts.
I know. Now, doctors are turning down, there's a report that doctors are turning down job offers in states with abortion bans. And that makes total sense to me, particularly OBGYNs turning down jobs in those states because essentially they can't do their jobs in a state.
And remember,
government is stepping in and saying, we know better than you do as a medical professional what you can and can't do to save a person's life. That's crazy.
And remember, a lot of these states are more rural states without large population centers, Texas excepted, where, you know, you've got large swaths of rural areas that don't have hospitals anymore, where people have to travel sometimes hundreds of miles just to get basic health care if they live in a rural part of the state. So,
and then if they travel hours to get to a population center and there's no OBGYN to see them, that's even worse for women. So I kind of feel at this point that if I were a woman of childbearing age living in a state like Texas or Idaho, I would just tell my significant other, my partner, my boss, everybody I know, I'm leaving. I'm going someplace where women are treated like human beings. Bye.
Yep.
Until you change the law and make it okay for me to live here and feel like my life isn't in danger, just going about my normal business, I'm out of here. I really feel like women kind of need to do that. It's a Liz Estrada moment.
It really is.
And make the men realize that you've made it so insanely hostile to women in your state that we're not standing for it anymore.
A lot of these movements, and we're going to see it also with the push to ban contraception, are mm-hmm. kind of assuming that women will go quietly back to their 19th century roles. And that's not going to happen.
Nope.
And our economy is not structured that way anymore. You know, our economy cannot support taking half of the workforce out of the workforce, which is really what they're after. They want women barefoot and pregnant. You know, that old trope had a lot of truth behind it. And that is a lot of where these, culture warriors are coming from. It's really appalling.
All right. That pretty much is all the time we got for this week.
Well, that's good. We wanted to end on an upbeat note.
Yeah.
But there's, a couple of events.
Yes, we should talk about that. Today is the, does the math quickly in my 77. Thank you. Year anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And as happens every year at this time, we've got some annual commemorations of that. Tonight from 6 to 9 p.m., there will be, Hiroshima to Hope, the floating of the lanterns on Green Lake at the boathouse on the west side of Green Lake. That really is a beautiful event. If you've never been, you should treat yourself and treat your kids. And then tomorrow and Monday, Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action is having its annual actions around Hiroshima Day. Go and check their website at gzcenter.org to find out all the events and the different times. It's at 16159 Clear Creek Road in Poulsbo. It's right across the street from the Beggar Nuclear Subbase.
All right. Well, with that, we'll hopefully talk with you both next week.
I'll be here.
I'll be here.